Hey, welcome back to another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you like it is and gives you information you can use. And as always, we kind of do three segments or parts of the show, if you will. And what those start out is relevant political commentary on stories of the day. It also comes down to some critiques and comments on the gun media, gun content that's out there. And then my favorite part, which is always questions and answers. Last podcast, the question and answers part, the introduction to it was kind of truncated, but all the material is there. So when we go from commentary to, hey, let's talk about bolt action rifles, military rifles, well, that was actually the start of the Q&A part. So apologize if that created any confusion on anyone's part, but that's what that was. So let's get down into it. And again, you couldn't hire Mel Brooks to write funnier political commentary. And this time we're talking about the great city of Baltimore. And it's really a shame. I have my father was born in Baltimore, by the way, many, many, many years ago. And Baltimore, up until the 1950s, was a beautiful city. It was the jewel of the mid-Atlantic states. It was a prosperous, sophisticated city. It was a place that a lot of people were able to start businesses. It really was a great city, and it had a lot of great great people there. And some of those people were descended from the freed slaves, the freedmen who were there, and they started businesses and helped create a really nice culinary atmosphere in the city with cooking and restaurants and all kinds of fine things. Baltimore was considered just a great city. But since the 1950s, it's degraded into what you see now, which is this horrible, terrible place. And to show you, you couldn't hire a comedy writer to do this. Elijah Cummings, after his passionate defense and the passionate defense of the liberals of Baltimore, while he's defending Baltimore, his house is being robbed. Apparently, I guess he actually showed up and scared away the intruder. And unless the intruder felt that he was going to fall asleep, that Cummings by talking could put him to sleep or something, I don't think they had much to fear there. But he doesn't look like to me like he could scare much off. But anyway, while he's defending what a great place it is, he's being robbed. And to show you that you just can't make this stuff up. The deputy police commissioner Daniel Murphy, and if you look at a picture of this guy, he looks like just the nerdiest, little wimpiest dude. He has like a size 28 suit jacket. It looks like he's definitely under 40, and maybe even be under 30. You know, just thick glasses, the whole package of just a nerdy little guy. And he was he's the deputy police commissioner, and he was robbed at gunpoint. And so that tells you what a wonderful, safe place Baltimore is. With literally within a very short period of time, their congressman and their deputy police commissioner are robbed. And if you need any more help, and this is actually not laughable, but they have, I think they've had 185 homicides this year. So what does that tell you about Baltimore? What that tells you is that essentially, again, President Trump is right. Everybody wants to jump on him. Everybody wants to criticize him for what he says. But it turns out he was exactly right. So that's Baltimore. And during the Baltimore riots, you know, when they had the shooting, and I mean, I think it was about less than a year ago. Didn't their mayor have to resign because she had mental problems or something? I mean, this place is a mess, and yet all Cummings can worry about is the southern border, right? And trying to block any kind of constructive effort there to keep the wrong people out, put up a strategy to let the right people in, and have some order to our and rule of law in our immigration system. He's all worried about that when his home district is chaos. I mean, it's absolutely chaos, and he needs to worry about that. And I think it is an interesting question. Where did the $16 billion that's been spent to help them, where did that all go? You know, whose bank accounts were fattened by that? That's the real crime in all this, that there's a lot of good people in Baltimore who are not getting the help they deserve because, you know, it's being stolen from them. Same kind of thing we talked about Somalia a couple of casts back. And this is the same thing. Here, aid and money comes to them and somehow it gets stolen and moved somewhere where it's not helping anyone. Somebody just steals it and keeps it for their own use. So there probably needs to be a huge investigation. And unfortunately, like Trump said, Baltimore is just one of a list of cities that's run by people who don't care about their citizens and have let great cities just fall into complete decay and chaos. Well, of course, we talked about how rare bear attacks were, and we've gone over this a couple of times. But, you know, I was looking back, and apparently within like the last 4 or 5 months, there's been 6 or 8 bear attacks. So, you know, I guess everybody, when they talk about bear attack, you know, what's the best firearm to carry in defense of a bear? And, well, if I can't carry a long gun, what would be the best handgun? You know, funny part of this is a lot of the bear attacks, we always think of grizzly bear attacks. You know, you think of the giant brown bear, grizzly, or a polar bear, you know, these massive animals that are huge. But apparently the most of the attacks that you kind of see, and these are not all the time, they're still comparatively rare, but It's black bears, and black bears are normally shy. They're a lot smaller, but you know, they've become to the point where they're used to getting food from humans, and the food they're getting from humans, they're used to it. They know where to get it, and they're not showing fear of people, and that's a very bad sign. When a bear does not show fear of you, that means that you could get attacked because they're not just going to scuttle away. And some of these attacks are very frightening. If you're jogging on a trail, and face it, everybody kind of likes to run, you know, through the woods that you think are comparatively safe. It's a bad deal when you run across, you know, a bear and it comes after you because it associates you with having food, not necessarily to eat you as food, but thinks that you have food on you. And, you know, this isn't comical. This isn't Yogi and Boo Boo in Jellystone Park looking for picnic baskets. This is the serious stuff. And this is how people can get hurt. This is how people get hurt by bears. And a bear is, even a small bear is a very, very powerful animal. And then you put in the fact that outside of foraging for food, if you get in between a mother bear and her cubs, of course, the natural animal instinct is to protect the young. And so having bears in proximity of people can be very, very dangerous. And unfortunately, when these bears start attacking people, they get into that, even if they only do it once, it becomes a pattern of behavior. The bear has to be euthanized. They just can't take it and release it somewhere else. Bears have, as they said, excellent memories. Bears have excellent ability to move across country, and they have very large ranges. So even if you take a bear and move it miles and miles away, there's an excellent chance it could come back. And, you know, it's going to be looking for food again. And if people are in the way, it's definitely going to get in there and attack. And especially since bears hibernate, you know, they spend a lot of time gathering food because they want to get big and large and hibernate and lose weight. Then they, you know, they hibernate and lose all that weight over the winter, but they have to go into it to survive the hibernation. They have to go in there with a lot of fat, a lot of calories. So, you know, food is always on their mind. Bears don't really frolic. All they do is look for food. So that's one of the things that makes them a particular challenging creature to be around. So I think, you know, it's definitely something that people should keep in mind. And I don't know how you really jog with a rifle or handgun. I mean, that seems to be pretty tough. But if you're out there walking, you definitely can carry something. And we said last time, you know, if it's black bear country, maybe a police 40 Smith & Wesson, you know, one of those trade-ins that's, you know, got some wear on it, but is still very serviceable and fires a pretty potent round. Maybe that's a very, very good weapon to have. I mean, certainly better than nothing, certainly better than the spray or the clenched fist or anything. I just don't know of a good non-lethal bear repellent. I don't know what really works. The spray just seems to me to be a very last-ditch thing where you have to be within contact distance of the animal, which is always a very bad place to be. And, you know, there have been in the past, most of the brown bear attacks, you know, a lot of times those are against people who are out hunting. So it's, you know, they're actually armed and they're armed with, you know, pretty serious weapons, and bears can sneak up on them and kind of catch these hunters by surprise. So, you know, vigilance is important. Also, going out in a group. If you're going to jog with friends, and maybe somebody can at least carry a belt pouch with something in it. Maybe a Taurus Judge or something might be a great thing just to have. It's certainly better than nothing. But I just thought that as luck always has it, when you talk about how rare bear attacks are, you seem to read about five or six of them in the next couple of weeks. And that's certainly what's happened here. I don't know if you caught this, but around one of the sports stadiums in Denver, I think it's their soccer stadium, they actually had to close it down because they have all of these fleas there that are carrying bubonic plague. And of course, they're going to infest things like squirrels and groundhogs and any kind of, you know, rats, I suppose mice, I don't. And of course, that can be transferred to dogs and cats and domestic animals. And this is not new. I remember I lived on a ranch. I grew up on a ranch, and the county would put out warnings that there was, you know, stay away from the ground squirrels because they had fleas that were carrying bubonic plague. This is serious business. This is very serious business. And it shows you that there are times when you have to eradicate populations or at least seriously reduce populations of some of these animals just simply because of the threat they carry towards humans. And it also, you know, kind of brings back the fact that nature is wild and nature is nature. And there are things out there, even in our modern day, that can still hurt you. There's, you know, ticks, fleas, all kinds of little diseases that can happen out there. One of the scariest, not gun-related, but it's that flesh-eating bacteria that can get up in your nose and attack your brain and central nervous system. You know, just knowing this kind of stuff is out there really makes you really need to take pause and say, hey, you know, it's not Disney out there. It's not a Disney world, or it's not what you see on television where things are all rosy and great. There is stuff out in nature that can still affect us because we are, after all, you know, we're animals just in the animal kingdom like everything else. And if you're not careful, you can wind up on the menu, you know, alligators and all kinds of other things. And even things that won't eat you, there are things that will take a bite out of you, like snakes and a few other things. So this is part of the reason that we have and use firearms, is to protect us from these threats that are out there. And some of them are existential threats, at least to you personally. You know, I don't know about you, but I don't want to tangle with a bear, and I don't want to tangle with a gator or anything else. But there's a few other things out there that are just as dangerous. And one can think of bubonic plague carrying fleas and also poisonous snakes are some of them. Okay. More NRA news. Okay, three board members have resigned because they were taken off the committee. And I opined earlier to steal a term that someone else uses. But my opinion earlier was, hey, this reeked of just kind of petty retaliation. And I didn't really like the fact that they had been stripped of their committee assignments. And I think that should have been addressed. It's too late now. They've resigned. So I kind of look at it this way. I think their resignation was a knee-jerk response. I think they owed it to the organization to stay in there. And if they're asking questions, you can ask a question as effectively if you're a committee member as if you're not, if you're an NRA board member, I'd assume. And I don't know. I just think that's bad business. But what that's really showing you, 3 out of 75 of them or 76 of them is not a tremendous percentage. And I'm frankly at the point now where I don't care about Wayne LaPierre's suits. I really don't. I don't care about the suits. I don't care about the apartment for the intern that was there over the summer. Yeah, they shouldn't have paid it. I don't really care about the travel. I don't really care about any of that anymore. At first, I was kind of put off like everybody else was. Hey, you know, but you know, and thinking about it, the bigger picture is we got to protect the Second Amendment. And whether you like it or not, we have to go with what we have. And what we have is one large influential organization, the NRA. We have affiliated or allied state organizations. And that is a very powerful construct, very powerful. Doesn't win all the time, but it wins a lot of the time, and that's a good deal. Then there are other organizations which I support in concept. I'm not a member of every one, but I support them in concept. And I believe that they should pile on. You know, they should pile on to these lawsuits and say, hey, you know, the NRA and the, you know, whatever state organization are suing over this law, and they should pile on. They should file the amicus briefs or become partners in the lawsuit, however all that works. They should do that. And that's one of the strengths of the pro-gun rights movement. Is that we can, you know, all kind of focus in on something, and we know what's bad and we know what's good in the legislation and and we know who our enemies really are. But if we start fighting amongst ourselves and keep this going, it's not going to help us in 2020. We need help in 2020. We need a focused effort. Whether you like Wayne LaPierre or not, whether you think his suits were too expensive or not, it's time just to buckle down and make your contributions. And if you just want to contribute to the ILA, that's fine, because that's a separate, kind of a separate deal, so it can do its political work. And that money is going to go towards the political work. So these morons, and I think Tom Gresham is one, and some of these YouTube guys are another ones, when they say, I'm not going to give another penny. Well, there's a couple of different aspects to the NRA, and giving it to the ILA is a good way that you can help ensure that your money is going to fight for the Second Amendment. And that's what needs to happen. And, you know, they'll straighten out this other business problems and, you know, the lawsuit with New York and all the rest of it. You know, that will all get straightened out, and that will all get helped. But, you know, these guys who have a grudge against the NRA, almost every one of them I've seen, this is a long-standing grudge, and really kind of tired of it. These people have gotten way more than their 15 minutes of fame, and it's time that they sit in the background and really start thinking about gun rights and start thinking about what gun rights come down to is what you as an individual can do with a firearm, what you can own, and what you can protect yourself with, either in the home or outside the home. That's what gun rights, a big part of it, is about. And you know, we need to focus a lot more on that, and all this carping just needs to cease. Three members have resigned. That's their choice. That's their conscience. That's fine. That's their decision. But now it's over. And we all have to move on, and we have to move past this. I mean, we just have to move past this. The guy who's been carrying the torch and saying that is the second vice president, Willis Lee. You know, he's got the big picture. The big picture is, hey, people are after our gun rights, and if we don't oppose them every step of the way, we're definitely going to lose some ground. So that's one thing we should all keep that in mind. Okay, content creators, I've had enough fun with InRange TV. I have to say that, you know, after this DSA FAL debacle that has just been posted up there, I'm probably done with them for a while. I mean, I'm just probably done with them. I'm tired of the dress up. I'm tired of some of the other shenanigans and some of these guys they're bringing in. You know, it has not impressed me the last couple of months, I have to tell you. And so therefore, I'm probably going to just, you know, ease back and not watch them for a while. They have to win me back as a viewer because of this nonsense. They're going to have to win me back. That's what it is. But on the best side of all this is I found another creator that I'd seen before, but I'm really, really much more interested in now. And that is it's called British Muzzleloaders, and it's a Canadian guy. And he's into basically British weapons going from, you know, the muzzleloading era all the way up to the number four Lee Enfield. As I'm stumbling over my words, the number four Lee Enfield, which is really great. You know, that hits everything all the way up to the past the end of World War II into the 1950s. And I don't know what the laws are in Canada vis-a-vis owning a semi-auto FAL. I imagine they're much more stringent. So whether he delves into anything more modern is anyone's guess. But anyway, he covers a lot of ground, a lot of hand loading, some of the courses of fire, and a lot of the other things that are very, very interesting. If you like old school historical guns, that is a place to go, especially if you like the British weapons. And, you know, up until recently when they became priced like everything else, the British weapons and British militaria was some of the least expensive on the market. You know, it was, I can remember British helmets were practically given away. You buy them for a few dollars and nobody really wanted them. And this is in the 90s and not that long ago. And now all this stuff is kind of catching up, but it's still a lot of British surpluses and their militaria and their rifles are out there on the market. And so it's a really, really interesting field with a lot of different historical eras and definitely a lot of different interest areas for collectors, historians, and people who just enjoy rifles in general. I can move to my favorite part of the podcast, which is questions and answers. And got some interesting ones this time. One of them was brought up in conjunction with one of the friends of the podcast who tipped me off on something very, very good. But coincidentally, I got a question from a coworker. It was about the Webley revolvers, 45 caliber, the 455 Webley revolvers that were imported into the country in scads during the 1950s and probably early 60s, when the British Commonwealth, they were dumping these things surplus and they were very economically priced. However, there was no 455 ammo. You had these revolvers and no ammunition for them. So enterprising importers would grind off the rear of the cylinder, and if this makes your teeth clench, it should, but they would grind off the rear of the cylinder a few thousandths of an inch and make it so you could use half moon clips of 45 ACP in the revolvers, and everything fit. Everything was copacetic. Everything seemed to work. The problem was that the 45 ACP in hardball service loadings, 230 grain FMJ bullet, was really pretty hot for a Webley. Now, most of the Webleys have withstood it, but it really wasn't something that should really be done. So while it would fit the revolver and function in the revolver, it did not help the long-term durability of the revolver. So in place of using these full service loads, most hand loaders would just do what I do, which is you load a 200 grain lead bullet over a very modest, you know, one of the lower end powder charges, and you can use it in clips, or you can use 45 auto rim brass, and you know, you can then make safe loads for the revolver, and the extractor punches them out, everything is good. Well, some people understandably still would like to be able to use the original 455 ammo now that there's some modestly available on the market. And some people would like to use that and fire the original loading out of the revolver. Well, until now, it's been impossible to, quote, put steel back, to ungrind the the rear of the cylinder. It's been impossible to do that. There's just no way. However, there's a place called partsforantiqueguns.com, which produces a ring. And it's a very simple thing. It's a ring a few thousandths of an inch thick that you place on the back of your Webley revolver cylinder, and it basically makes it so you can shoot those rounds again. Now, they come in the white, so you could blue them, and it'll never look original. I mean, you'll be able to know what's in there, but at least you can use the original ammo. And I think I used to call it Fiocchi, but people call it Fiocchi. I think Fiocchi and PPU probably produce that round. So you can fire the original round and see, you know, how well the sights are regulated and all that kind of good stuff. So it's a way that you can at least, although you can't undo the modification, you can certainly mitigate it. And, you know, it's really an ingenious idea. And I got a chance to examine one of these. It looks exceptionally well made. And I will say that the revolver does seem 455 is a lot lower pressure and lower, I don't want to say lower performance, but lower velocity than I thought. So, you know, you can definitely see why 45 hardball was really inappropriate for these converted Webley revolvers. And they're not cheap anymore. A Webley revolver is not cheap anymore. The 45 ones have never really been, since maybe they were cheap back in the 50s and 60s, but then they started really gaining popularity. And the earlier models, the ones earlier than the Mark IV, some of those were even, you know, only proof for black powder. So yeah, definitely 45 ACP in a black powder revolver is probably not very, very good. So this is really a great step forward so that you can go back and shoot the original ammo. And so that's pretty good. But Webleys are not cheap anymore. The 45s have been expensive for a long time. The 38s, they imported a lot of those in the 90s, and those weren't going for much, 80s and 90s. And but even now, those are commanding 4 or 5 times the original importation price. So the Webleys are out there, and I like the Webleys. They're a fun historical gun to shoot. The people who say they're the best combat revolver ever, I think, are sadly mistaken. The best combat revolver ever is really up for debate, but it's certainly not the Webley. My vote would go to the Smith & Wesson Model 1917. I think that's probably the best military combat revolver ever. For civilians, you know, you can, they're, I think it still goes to Smith & Wesson, but they have a lot of end frame and even smaller frames that are great revolvers. And then there's always the Colt Python. But for military service, the Model 1917, I think, was the best. I certainly find it more comfortable to shoot than the Colt New Service, just, you know, ergonomically, the way the hand, the trigger, and all that kind of work together. But the Colt was definitely, the Colt New Service Model 1917 was definitely also a very rugged, reliable, durable revolver. Nothing wrong with it. It just, my preference is for the Smith & Wesson 1917. And as you know, both the 1917 revolvers, the Colt model and the Smith & Wesson model, both got the designation 1917, which leads to endless confusion sometimes. But it's all good. And the Smith & Wesson is really the one that survived even into later. It evolved into later civilian models. And they've also brought it out in, I believe, a special run a few years ago of a kind of a commemorative or a retro revolver. Horribly, I think they put a case-hardened finish on it. Why they do that? I don't know. Why would you make a gun that is essentially a newer version of an older model and not make it look like the older model? Why would you have a case-hardened frame, which the originals never had, and frankly, just look weird to me? I like case-hardened parts. I like hammers and triggers and other things that are case-hardened. I don't care for a whole revolver frame, though, that's case-hardened. But there even, I think, was it Turnbull turned out some case-hardened, his version of an AR-10, the whole thing was case-hardened. Yeah, kind of this molted, weird look. I just thought it was very, very strange. But anyway, the old 45 Webleys, if it's converted to 45 ACP, can now be used with the original ammo, with just the addition of this ring made by PartsForAntiqueGuns.com. Hey, here's another question. What caliber are your CCW pistols, and what caliber is your open carry sidearm? And the answer to that is fairly straightforward. I don't open carry anything unless, like if I'm out in the woods or something like that, a place where it's appropriate. I don't believe in open carry in town. I wouldn't go into Walmart open carrying. I just think that's all just trouble. Trouble waiting to happen. And I live in a state that allows constitutional carry. So, I mean, I can carry concealed anywhere I want to. So that's normally what I do. Although I am a 1911 and 45 enthusiast, and I love large in-frame revolvers, I love all that, I really don't carry those concealed very much. They are difficult to conceal. I realize there are some artisans who can make holsters that, you know, fit in the small of your back and, you know, all kinds of places, and you can carry large guns. But it's I normally carry a 9mm style pistol, usually a single stack. I just find that that's the most practical compromise between power, concealability, and capacity. You know, a lot of service style guns, and I'm talking the larger, you know, 5-inch barrel or 4 to 5-inch barrel semi-automatic pistols, double stack 9mm, something like a Beretta 92, is more challenging to conceal. It can be done, but it usually comes out to be a heavier package and a lot larger. I'm one of those people, I don't want somebody to guess I'm carrying. I want something discreet. There are times when you can't even carry a single stack 9mm, and I was going to a Civil War commemoration event a couple years ago, and frankly, I knew there would be some Confederate flags there, not flown as any sort of a political statement, but as part of the historical scheme. But you never know when something like an Antifa or like some sort of protest or some sort of hassle is going to happen there. And, you know, there was a joint color guard of Union and Confederate reenactors who were there. And I mean, we, you know, the stuff was there. And you never know who's going to show up there, who's going to be a problem. So my problem was, how was I going to discreetly arm myself just in case something bad happened? And I went down to a much smaller caliber pistol. I went with a Walther PPK, which is about as small as I like to go. I mean, I don't know that a I don't know that a Browning Baby 25 is really going to get you much. I mean, it is a firearm and it is there, but to me, the Walther is just feels right. And there are a lot of guns that are fit in that size envelope, which are way too numerous, and frankly, there's some that are very, very attractively priced, depending on which manufacturer you go to. And you can go 380 or 32. And as I've stated before, I don't know that there's a whole lot of difference between them. But I went to a very, very small, discreet package like that. I was wearing a vest. It fit in the pocket with a pocket holster, and nobody was any of the wiser, and yet I had some protection. So if something very bad had started to happen, I would have at least had something. Now, if something bad happened, would I prefer to have something else? Yes, but sometimes, there are compromises that have to be made. So it depends on, and I certainly wasn't expecting any problems. I thought the possibility of anything going wrong in this venue was very, very remote, because I think the best concealed carry strategy is to avoid any place that has the potential to turn very, very bad. If you think it's going to turn bad, don't arm yourself and go there. It's better to go somewhere else or stay home. That's my belief. I mean, avoiding trouble is a whole lot better. But there are times when you do have to be prepared, because even when you've done the analysis and figured that it's a very safe place to be and there's going to be no problems, a problem can occur. So, and it may be totally unrelated to what's going on around you. It could just be happen chance. So that's essentially what I believe in. And I do believe in high performance ammunition. That's just smart. Ball ammunition is great for practice, but high performance ammunition is much better if you're actually going to be shooting in a genuine situation. Very, very quick answer to a question that you could run 10 shows on and talk about preferences and all this, but I believe in smaller envelopes for CCW. Now, when I'm out in the woods, I'll carry other things, and that's usually when I love carrying a Ruger revolver, a large revolver, or a 1911 or something else. And I'm not saying I wouldn't carry those concealed somewhere, but and I'll just throw in one quick last thing. I want to kind of call it degrees of concealability. When I'm out in the woods, I usually carry with, and I'm wearing a windbreaker or maybe a light shirt over what I'm doing, so I don't look like Dirty Harry with the exposed shoulder holster out there. When I rode small motorcycles around out in the woods, I would have a gun in a shoulder holster, and it was the 6.24 I talked about. But I would always have something over it, even if it's just if it's a hot day, I'll just have a light shirt over that, wear the shoulder holster over a t-shirt, and that way it's just not readily apparent. Unless somebody's really up close to me, it's not readily apparent that I have a shoulder holster that I'm carrying. Same thing with same thing if I'm carrying a sidearm on my belt, 1911 or a 92. M9 type of gun. You kind of wear it's nice to wear a long vest or have a kind of a loose fitting overshirt, so that people really can't, unless they're right next to you, they really can't see what you have. And that's for out in the woods. That's not anything I would take into Walmart or walk down the street with. Here's another question. Is there a truly ambidextrous rifle or handgun? I know this because for some reason, I've come across some left-handed shooters lately. Guys, some of it is related to eye dominance. Some of it is because they're naturally left-handed. And what I've always believed is that left-handers are probably, about 10% of the population. So I guess extrapolating that, they would be 10% of the shooting market. And they probably have less than 5% of the products out there. And the reason for that is when you look at most gun designs, They are inherently right-handed, and they're right-handed guns with that have ambidextrous controls on them. It's just the way it is. A lot of gun designs, especially if they go back to the turn of the 20th century, that's when they used to, you know, beat people on the knuckles for being left-handed and force people to be right-handed. Also, if you're designing a bolt-action rifle, you're going to put the bolt handle on the right side of the gun where a right-hander can manipulate it quickly, because at least 90% of your troops are going to be right-handed. So you just go with the vast majority. And that's kind of unfortunate. It's in the world where fairness doesn't count for anything, it's certainly not fair. And even they've come out with designs. They actually came out with, I've seen completely left-handed mirror image 1911s that are completely left-handed. And I think Stag Arms did that with an AR for a while. They may even still have it somewhere. Completely left-handed. The problem with that is shooting that particular gun might be okay, but if you ever transition over to a standard AR, you're obviously that's going to be a bad deal. So the choice is you get to learn how to shoot a right-handed gun left-handed, and that's going to involve some compromises, and it's going to be somewhat uncomfortable. I think that Desert Tech MDR is about as close as I've seen to a truly ambidextrous design. Being a bullpup, and it looks like the ejection can be flip-flopped to either side, and the controls are completely ambidextrous. That might be about the closest there is, but you know, everything else, it's usually, and it ejects out the bottom. So I believe it does not eject out the bottom. I'm sorry. There are some that eject out the bottom, and those are pretty good also. But you know, you're never going to find, the vast majority of stuff you find is never going to be left-handed friendly. It may be usable, but it won't be friendly. There are some, and you know, when you go to look at sporting rifles, you can find certain models in left-handed configuration, but you're not going to find a lot, and you're not going to find every single model will have a left-handed version. It's usually probably some very popular models, and that is just what it is. So there's no truly ambidextrous rifle or handgun. I have seen where I've had this discussion, is the Colt single action really, when you look at where the loading gate is and all that, is that really more suited for a left-hander than a right-handed person? And I suppose you could look at that. One guy even tried to tell me, well, that's because Samuel Colt was left-handed. It's like, dude, Samuel Colt died over 10 years before the single action army, the 1873, came out. So unless you want to say that his percussion pistols were more left-handed friendly, I would actually say no, because I've watched people load and cap them, and it's much easier for a right-handed person to place the percussion caps on a percussion revolver. So, even if Samuel Colt was left-handed, which I doubt he was, but even if he was, he did not reflect that in his revolver designs. So, I don't believe there really is truly a lot of good left-handed guns out there. You'll find a few, but it's very difficult. And I'm actually at the point where I think if you're left eye dominant, and my left eye is stronger than my right eye, and I've trained myself to shoot with my right eye, I would get an eye patch, or I've seen guys put even a little bit of clear tape over their left eye and then force themselves to use their right eye. That to me seems to be a lot better solution, but you know, to each his own. I do know some people who shoot a rifle right-handed and a pistol left-handed and vice versa, and it's hard on them. It's a difficult it's very difficult for them to manipulate some of that, and you know, it's just one of those things. Like anything, it can be overcome with training and experience, but it is a hurdle out there, and there's not many truly ambidextrous designs. So that is kind of what it is. Okay, here's another question. Last podcast. You said the 1917 U.S. rifle was the best rifle of World War I or World War II, the best bolt-action rifle. I should copy that. I skipped over that. The best bolt-action rifle. Can you rate the rest? And first of all, there's way too many models for me to give a 1 to 10 rating. And I will also tell you that I don't think any rating is necessarily valid. And I base this on, since 2014, we've been doing, it started out as World War I commemorative shoots, but it's manually operated military rifle shoots. And everything has shown up there one time or another. Everything from Martini Henrys to rolling blocks to Model 95 Winchesters, and then just every bolt action you can imagine. And some of our highest scores, surprisingly, have been shot by 1886 LaBelle, 1907 16 Berthier, Lee Enfield, number one Mark III. And the, what's the other one? Like, we had a Krag carbine that took a, we had a side match, a carbine match, a Krag carbine took that. We've had a Krag finish, a Krag rifle finish first. We've had Moisin the Gant has shown up and done well. Now, that's not to say that so what I'm telling you is there is no wonder weapon. It's amazing when you can see an 1886 LaBelle shoot a better score than the vaunted Swiss K-31, but it happens. Because it's more about the shooter with those rifles than it is about the rifle itself sometimes. And when we first started, the common wisdom was that the 6.5 Swedes and the K-31s would dominate, and it would be a game of both of those. That if you wanted a competitive score, you would shoot both of those, and that turned out to be completely 180 degrees wrong. What we found out instead was shooters that practice and know where their gun hits, know where their point of impact is, do a lot better than people who think, well, I have a K-31, therefore I will win. Same thing with 6.5. And they've all turned in good scores. Make no mistake, we've had K-31s turn in great scores, and we've had, but any rifle on any given day in the right shooter's hand can turn in a winning score in these matches. And these are 200-yard matches. They're not, you know, you'd be surprised. 200 yards doesn't seem like a long way until you're looking down tangent sights. And the target we use looks like it wouldn't be very hard. It looks like it would be very hard to miss, but it's quite easy to miss. And so it's definitely, you would think the 03A3 with its peep sights and its adjustability would win every time, and it doesn't. And it doesn't. The 1903 can win or it cannot win. The 1917, I have found, if I had to do a trend, the 1917 produces probably better scores. And I attribute that to only one thing, that if the windage is set correctly, that is, the point of it's not shooting 2 feet to the right or 2 feet to the left or something, but if that windage is set correctly, that rifle with its easy to see front sight and the peep close to the eye rear sight gives a very, very good sight picture and is a very easy gun to use. The other things that really helped the 1917 is it's a ponderous, large, heavy rifle, and it soaks up that 30-06 recoil. So the lower recoil of the 6.5 doesn't really become a tremendous advantage because the 1917 doesn't have much recoil. And it's got a very good stock, which distributes the recoil well. Something that I don't really care. The 03A3 does not really do that to me unless it has a pistol grip stock or even a scant stock, but the regular stock on that does tend to let me know it's there and push back. And the other foreign military rifle bolt actions are somewhat the same. The hardest ones are the ones in really odd calibers, because it's difficult to hand load for them. It's difficult to find brass, and sometimes tuning them in is there. But you know, we had a, you know, and sometimes this is just how it works out. We had a match where the theme was the Gallipoli invasion, and one of our guys brought a rifle that had been at Gallipoli, and that was the rifle that shot the winning score, and it bested all these others. And so we don't know if that was there were some ghosts or good vibes or something helping out that rifle, but that's how it was. And the Lee Enfield, which is not known for accuracy, but at 200 yards, if you have the windage set, you know, there isn't a lot of crosswind between 0 and 200 yards that can really affect a 30 caliber bullet. You start getting out at 300 yards, you can see the effect, and beyond that, you can see the effect of crosswinds. But unless it's exceptionally heavy crosswind, you're not going to see a tremendous shift in point of impact from a crosswind at 200 yards. You're just not. So, you know, if you got a rifle that hits point of aim at 200 yards, you can do it, and you can shoot a very good score. So ranking them is very difficult. I would just say that the human ergonomics of the recoil, the stock, and the sights give the 1917 a good advantage. So what is the next one? The next question is, list the most dangerous things you've seen on shooting ranges. And the answer is, there's too many to list, but the one that just immediately popped into my head was, we do old West revolver shoots in Clay County, Missouri, kind of themed around the James gang. And so people show up. It's not cowboy action. It's more of an older style match where we're shooting at different style targets and things. It's fixed. It's shoulder to shoulder shooting at targets. It's not cowboy action where you're engaging. It's not one at a time where you're engaging steel or anything like that. People show up, and it's a very, very safe event. People kind of know. Well, one guy showed up. And this guy was dressed up like a biker, and almost everybody else, at least wears a cowboy hat and some sort of old West attire. But this guy was dressed up like a biker, and he had an 1858 Remington. I assume it was a Pieta or Uberti, you know, one of those. And he had one of the worst ideas you could ever have for one of those types of guns, for a black powder cap and ball gun. And that is, he had a conversion cylinder so he could fire 45 Colt out of that older gun, older style gun. Normally, these things are not a problem. Normally, these things they have cowboy action kind of loads, you know, very mild black powder or smokeless loads that they fire in the things, and they're not a problem. But there's not a lot of steel in between those chambers, and it's you know, not meant for powerful loads. Well, this guy had some HSM, which is a kind of a smaller company that does high performance ammunition, and normally a 45 Colt takes a 255 or 250 grain bullet, something like that. Well, these were like 280 grain, and they were actually marked on the box as bear loads. And this is a few years ago, so I don't know if that ammunition is even still around. So these things are bear loads, and they're essentially plus P or plus P plus, designed for the very strongest of revolvers. I wouldn't even fire them in a modern Colt single action or one of its clones. I mean, I think this was for more like a Red Hawk style revolver, or, you know, a Ruger Black Hawk, something that's a pretty stout revolver. And yet he had it, and he was trying to fit it in the cylinder of this 44 Remington black powder copy with the 45 Colt conversion cylinder, and the cylinder had paper thin walls. Now, the cartridges actually wouldn't fit. They were too long. So rather than taking that as a hint of maybe this ammunition won't really work in this revolver-cylinder combination, this guy was in the process of taking a penknife and just whittling down the bullets until these things would fit into the chamber. Needless to say, had he detonated, had he tried to actuate that cartridge, had he gotten it in there and, you know, indexed the cylinder around and dropped the hammer on one of these rounds, it would have exploded like a hand grenade. And in a shoulder-to-shoulder kind of environment where there's somebody, you know, a foot to your left and a foot to your right, not only would he have been injured, but they would have been injured also. And many people could have been injured. That thing would have shattered like glass, sending fragments everywhere. So that was probably one of the most dangerous things I've ever seen. And that is, you know, an overload that causes a gun to blow up is very bad. Other things I've seen are, you know, the usual things of people essentially flagging everyone with the muzzle, you know, sweeping the muzzle across a group of people. I was getting lectured on gun safety by an older member of a club I belonged to, and the guy basically swept me with his muzzle, you know, pointed it right at my head, you know, and I'm sitting there going, whoa, stop it. I've also been swept with a muzzle on military ranges, and that's not a good feeling either when that happens. So, you know, that's probably the most numerous thing I've ever seen is people sweeping with muzzles. The most dangerous thing is this horrible business of a cartridge that is not designed for a certain kind of gun. And, you know, it can get confusing and people can make a mistake. If it's, hey, I can shoot 45 Colt out of this, they believe it means all 45 Colt ammunition. And that's simply not the case. There's many, many cases where ammunition is unsuitable for guns, even though it's the same caliber. Modern ammunition, 45-70 ammunition in a trapdoor Springfield is another example that comes to mind. You can also think about 38 Super in the old 38 ACP guns. That's another example. And there's just example they used to load rifle only. 32-20, rifle only 25-20, and rifle only 38-40. Now, a lot of this is kind of going back a few years. I don't know if they've had any rifle-only rounds for quite a while, but you have to be careful, and you have to realize that some guns are suitable for all ammunition and other guns are not. I don't want to unduly scare or alarm people, but, you know, just understand what you have. A classic old school guns are designed for, you know, think about the ammunition at the time and do some research just to make sure that you're not putting something inappropriate in there. And I always believe in this, you know, that more moderate loads are the best ones simply because they don't wear the gun or stress the gun nearly as much as a top end load. There are a lot of people who, you know, want to magnetize their 44 Special or their 45 Colt. Hey, if you need that kind of performance, get a larger, more powerful gun. If you really need 45 Long Colt bare ammo, maybe you should be shooting a 454 Casal. That's what I would say is a better answer than trying to make a gun perform at the top of its performance limits. Just get a firearm that's built to do that. And so that what you're actually trying to do in it is really in the center of its performance limitations and not at the top end. Anyway, that's it for another edition of Old School Guns. Remember, if you like us and want to hear more, hit the like button, become a follower. And if you're a follower, we will notify you through Podbean. It does it automatically when the next episode is posted and you can listen in and enjoy. And if you have any comments or any questions, put them in the comments section and we'll be sure to get to them and answer them in the next podcast. This is Old School Guns, out.